greetings, everyone, and welcome to a special online event today that's very relevant for the season in which we find ourselves. It's called Bridging Partisan Divides, Four Keys to Reuniting Our Families, Communities, and Country. My name is Stephen Dynan. I'm the founder and CEO of the Shift Network, and I'm really thrilled to be hosting today's program, partially because I have a fire in my belly to help evolve our democracy. And I feel that the featured leader, Mark Gurzon, is one who is really bringing us forward in a very profound way to helping us to create a new American political culture based upon us working together in a much more collaborative fashion. Mark is known for his more than a decade of domestic and international conflict resolution trainings and sharing about best practices for dealing with divisive issues and partisan politics. He's really taken this on and worked with colleagues across the aisle from Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and Libertarians to co-launch the Bridge Alliance. He's also done healing retreats with political leaders and has a terrific book out this year called The Reunited States of America. So welcome, Mark.
Good to be with you, Stephen. Thanks so much.
Well, this is such an important topic this year. I mean, we found ourselves in a more divisive political season in probably decades, if ever. So what I've been witnessing in my travels and with my book is just the extent to which this is really hurting America. It's really, people are in pain in their hearts and their families and communities, just the amount of divisiveness, the toxicity. So we really need to come up with some real solutions, and I know you have them. So that's part of why I'm really excited that we're going to get not only this hour with you, but that also you've chosen to work with us to create a full 7-week program called Healing Our Political Divides. So we're very excited about that, and we'll get to hear more about that towards the end of today's program. So, Mark, let's begin with a bit about your backstory. I think that anytime we're talking about transforming a situation, it's good to know where you're coming from and how you had to bridge bitter political divides and to really turn them into constructive relationships.
Well, I'd love to talk about that for a minute because I had a deep experience with what I would call red America, conservative America, when I was growing up, Stephen. I grew up in a super conservative part of our country at a super conservative time. It was Indianapolis, Indiana in the 1950s, you know, which was my neighborhood was the home of the Ku Klux Klan, and everybody was Republican and arch Republican, and Indiana was a great supporter of Richard Nixon, and I grew up in just the heartland of conservatism. And then suddenly, at the age of 17, you know, boom, I went to college, and I went to a super liberal college in a super liberal city at a super liberal time, which was Harvard College in Cambridge, Massachusetts during the late 1960s. So I've got some red and I've got some blue in me, Stephen, and I personally think we all do. And one reason I'm excited about working with you and Shift is that I don't want to cut off a part of myself just to belong to some political party. I really want to live in a technicolor America, and, you know, I want to live in, you know, the title of my book, I want to live in the Reunited States of America, and that's, to me, what the work we're doing this year is all about.
Well, I think what you're pointing out, that we have a piece of red and blue in each of us, is so important, because that's really, I think, at the deepest root of, like, how do we evolve beyond where we are, is to first realize that other people are holding a part of ourselves, and that if we're warring with them, that we're really warring with a part of ourselves in many ways. So
Exactly. And the question is, what's just like in our culture, what's the relationship between the left and the right? What I'm excited about exploring with you and Shift is that, what's the relationship between left and right inside us? You know, is it an amicable, respectful dialogue going on inside us between our red and blue parts, or is it some kind of, you know, warfare? Or have we suppressed one side, you know, and tried to pretend it's not there?
That's really interesting. It takes it into a psychological dimension. Well, I also think before we get into the principles you want to talk about, I'd love for you to share a little bit about your backstory of working. Working with healing political divides at a national level, and then also some of the recent work you've been doing as well.
Well, my baptism, Stephen, in this work was when I worked for the U.S. Congress about 20 years ago, exactly 20 years ago, and I designed the retreats for the U.S. House of Representatives, and I took over half of the members of Congress to Pennsylvania. And when I say it was a whole team, including the Aspen Institute and the congressional offices and funded by foundations. And it was the biggest movement of in peacetime of members of Congress ever, and the whole point was to develop stronger relationships. So for me, that was a baptism because my bosses were five Democrats and five Republicans who were supposed to make sure retreats were successful, and it was a real teaching for me because I realized that inside the hearts of these politicians, there's some really decent, caring, respectful, honorable people, and on both sides, and that's what really taught me. If we can let that goodness and that decency and that care and that compassion and that capacity to collaborate, if we can activate that, you know, we can get our country back on track. But right now, all those qualities I just mentioned are totally, totally in suppression. And instead, we've got toxicity, hostility, lying, deceit, attack, and vehement, vitriolic disrespect. So that's the challenge we're facing.
So a lot of us, we see the political food fight going on. We despair about it. Rates of approval of Congress are something like 18% now, probably some of the lowest in history. So we often think of it's like a problem with them. It's out in Washington. It's out in the media. But how does this actually bridge into our personal lives more substantially as well?
Well, for me, it bridges in. It's a very personal choice, Stephen. For me, it's a choice. Do I want to live in the disunited states of America, or do I want to live in the reunited states of America? And I think that's my personal choice, and I've made the personal commitment, and I think you have too, and I know others have as well, to say I'm going to live in a sacred America. I'm going to live in the reunited states of America. And what does that mean? Well, that's what we're going to explore, you know, in this conversation and in the course. And for me, it's, you know, the good news is we all know the bad news. All you have to do is open the newspaper and you can see the bad news. But the good news is that, you know, our leaders actually, in private, demonstrate real respect. I mean, I'm going to share in the course a letter from George H.W. Bush when he lost the presidency to Bill Clinton. And, you know, he literally left a note on the desk for Bill Clinton saying, you know, you will be our president when you read this note. I wish you well. Your success now is our country's success. I am rooting hard for you. Okay, so this is George H.W. Bush losing to Clinton saying, you know, I'm with you, I'm rooting hard for you. And most people don't know that, but most people don't know that, you know, 8 years later when Clinton's vice president, Al Gore, lost that very, very close election and George Bush became president, Gore was, you know, bitter and hurt and angry and disappointed and felt he'd been cheated. And yet he stands up there and gives his concession speech and he says, you know, something like, you know, partisan feeling must yield to patriotism. I'm with you, Mr. President, and God bless you. So, you know, our leaders know how to, you know, when they've lost, or they know how to be decent and caring and respectful and supportive and have a level of trust. And I think we've forgotten that, you know, because the last 16 years since that happened, the last 16 years have been so bitter and so toxic, we've forgotten that we actually know how to bridge the partisan divide.
Great. Well, we talked in describing today's program, we're talking about four keys to really transform the situation. So I would love for you to just launch into what do you really see as the first key for reuniting our families, communities, and country?
Well, I'd like to talk about each of the four, but I want to say that for me, they relate directly. Again, it's very personal. And for me, these are really physical, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual commitments that I make. So the tools or the skills or what we're calling keys to me are essentially, you know, physically, emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually, how do I live in the country of my dreams rather than the country of my nightmares? And for me, that starts with, you know, when I enter the political sphere, when I enter the civic sphere, do I enter with the attitude, hey, I've got all the answers, I know what's right, and I'm going to convince all of you that I'm right? Or do I enter the civic sphere by saying, I have my strong opinions, and I'm getting together here with my neighbors or my, you know, fellow citizens to learn together and create the best solution for all of us. So for me, learning is really the key principle, and the founding fathers, you know, knew this. They knew that citizens had to be learners, which is why, you know, they put in place public education and public universities, and why Jefferson said we had to reinvent our democracy every generation. I mean, they knew that in 1776, Stephen, they couldn't give us a blueprint that we could use for the next, you know, 200 years. They knew we had to keep learning. Yet when you look at our public discourse now, you know, remind me, tell me any time when Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or any of these people looked like they were learning. You know, when did they say, wow, I learned a lot, you know, from this conversation, or I learned a lot last week when I, or I learned a lot from this debate, or, you know, the hardest thing for them to say is I learned a lot from my adversary. They simply never model learning, and I think that's to me the first key.
Yeah. Well, I think that's so important. It's like, because when you're in a combat mode, it's just all about defeating the enemy versus like an evolutionary mode where we're really trying to together go to another level of evolution as a country. So I think I really resonate with what you're sharing.
And it was for me, it's personal too. I'm sure you've learned a lot as you've been promoting your book. And when I worked with Congress and since then, I just learned an enormous amount because, you know, I came out of college, you know, a liberal. And, you know, Harvard College in the 60s, it made me a liberal. And I had to really, it took me a while to learn, and that work with Congress was one of my teaching moments where I had to learn, wow, conservatives have actually a lot they're bringing to the table. And it's not like the liberals are right and the conservatives are wrong. It's actually like both of them are bringing a lot to the table. And you know, for me, the reason I start with the physical dimension and embodiment is that, you know, I think our bodies are a key to the fact that left and right are supposed to work together. You know, every time we walk, you know, we put our left foot forward and then our right foot forward. You know, every time we look at anything, we're using our binocular vision of our left eye and our right eye. And we're right now, people who are listening to this are listening with their left ear and their right ear. I mean, we've got, our bodies are telling us, you know, we need both these sides of ourselves to really see, hear, feel, move. It's just part of who we are.
Well, look, before we go further into the four keys, I wonder if you can share just a little bit more about your understanding of why we have such political divisiveness, just in kind of maybe the psychological roots a bit more about why do we get into this in this state?
Well, I think the truth is, Stephen, that as we go up the ladder, partisanship increases. So when I worked in the 90s on community level, there was definitely partisanship, but it tended to be muted by the fact that people were neighbors. And they drove the same streets, and their kids went to the same schools, and they lived in the same valley or, you know, plains or wherever they lived. They lived in the same community. So, but as you went up the level of abstraction, you know, from the local community to the city to the state to the nation, you went from face-to-face heartfelt interactions to non-face-to-face, you know, head interactions. And that shift is absolutely crucial to understanding why things have gotten so divisive because, you know, when the country started, you know, there was just a handful of people involved, you know, a handful of basically white landowning men living in a few of the major states who were making decisions for the country. And, you know, it was, you could probably measure the actual players in the thousands or tens of thousands, whereas now we're 350 million people and we all expect to have our voices heard, you know, whether we're gay or straight or transgender or not, or, you know, handicapped, physically able, physically disabled, you know, black, white, rich, poor, you know, Spanish speaking, whoever we are, we expect to be heard and listened to and paid attention to. So we really have to, you know, break out of that mold of a few people making decisions. We need to figure out how do we include everyone in this process, and that's led to this, the danger of abstraction. And I'll just close with a story, Stephen, because I think it'll illustrate it. I was on a radio show in New York where I was supposed to be moderating between an ardent pro-gun person and an ardent anti-gun person. And I realized that I could be on this radio show till hell freezes over and they would never listen to each other or agree. So I finally said to them, would you pause for just a minute and imagine that your parents of children, your neighbors and your children go to the same school? Are you willing to make that school safer for your kids tomorrow? Are the two of you willing to sit down together and talk? And I realized as I made that intervention, Stephen, that I was trying to get them go from the abstractions. I was trying to get them to go from the abstractions of pro-gun and anti-gun, which they were totally committed to being, you know, neighbors with kids going to the same school. And I think that's the shift I'm hoping that we can make it in the course and in our work together, is taking these abstractions that make us hate each other down to the heart and body level where we actually can find common ground.
That's a really interesting point, that the further we get out from local embodied connections, the more contentious it gets and gets more up in our heads. Fascinating. Well, let's go further into the keys that you want to talk about. What do you want to share next there?
Well, I think emotionally, I mean, the key to me to this challenge is, you know, is, and it's not surprising, is relationship. That's something that when people, you know, hear about relationship, they think, oh, this is a course about marriage, you know, or this is a course or our work about families, or this is about, you know, relationships at work. They tend to think in terms of relationships when it has to do with home and work and personal life. But what I've realized is that, you know, again, if you can see through the levels of abstraction, what's really going on the national level now? It's about relationship, you know, the relationship between a Paul Ryan and a Donald Trump, or the relationship between a Hillary Clinton and a Bernie Sanders, or, of course, the relationship between a Hillary Clinton and a Donald Trump. Those are relationships. And the biggest relationship that I think we need to look at is the relationship between the so-called liberals and the so-called conservatives who are represented by the Democratic and Republican parties. And that is a relationship. And I was trained as a family therapist, a family systems therapist. And I look at it from that point of view, and I ask myself, is the relationship on November 10th, Stephen, is that relationship going to be a healthy relationship? And what can we do to make that relationship healthy? Well, obviously, what's going on now is absolutely destroying that relationship. I mean, what we've seen in the news recently is literally the destruction of the relationship, an honorable, respectful, caring relationship between left and right. Instead, you know, we've heard, you know, very, very dangerous and threatening and hostile, mutually hostile statements about each other, calling each other liars and far worse, you know, and crooks and threats to the United States, et cetera. So to me, the next key is relationship, and I'm really interested in the question, not only who's going to win on November 9th, which is important, and I care about it, and we can talk about that, but what I really care about is on November 10th, will the winning side and the losing side at the national level and the state level, will the winning and losing side work together in the best interests of the American people? And that's just as important as the horse race and who wins and loses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really well said. Let's talk about how to deepen those relationships. You know, what are some of the principles you've seen that really work, especially in talking with in the partisan arena?
Well, one of the keys is, you know, is again the attitude. To go back to the first key, which is learning. And if, you know, let's just take the gun issue. You know, if you're somebody who's listening to this and you say, I wish we were more like Sweden. I wish we were more like Norway. I wish we had no guns. I wish our police had no guns. I wish there were no guns anywhere. I wish, you know, if there were guns, there were just a couple of them in private somewhere, but basically we were a gun-free society. You know, if you have that attitude and that perspective, can you reach out and develop a relationship with someone who actually feels like, you know, we need guns? You know, Sandy Hook and these other places, it's very clear that there are dangerous people and that unless there are guns, you know, we're at danger. So, you know, I want a gun present somewhere in good hands in my children's school to protect them in case there's another Sandy Hook. So are you willing to have a relationship with someone who holds a different point of view on that issue or any issue? And to me, that's the key. Are you wanting to learn? Are you wanting to be curious? Einstein, you know, used the phrase holy curiosity. Do you have a holy curiosity about democracy? Are you willing to sit down and really dive in and have a relationship? And when I say relationship, I don't mean you have to marry them. You know, I'm not talking about a relationship like, you know, we have with our husbands or wives, but a relationship where you literally open your eyes, you open your heart, you open your mind, and you actually encounter this person and you listen. And what I've realized, Stephen, is, you know, I began as a, just to take the gun issue, I began as a, you know, hardcore liberal, thinking, yeah, God, if we'd only get rid of these guns, look at these other countries with the fewer guns, they have fewer deaths, fewer homicides. And then I realized, you know, that was a simplistic answer. And we actually need, we need protection, you know, and we need protection in key places in our society. And the question is, how does a school, just to take that, how does a school build protection into the heart of the school? So a crazy gunman like happened in Sandy Hook cannot walk in and start madly killing for 20, 30 minutes without someone stopping them. I mean, that's a real fundamental issue. And if we don't hold that in our hearts, as, you know, let's say we're a liberal, if we don't hold that in our hearts, not only can't we work with conservatives, but I don't think we'll ever make our children safer.
That's a really good point. So there first has to be a, like really taking seriously the other positions, like stepping out of our own shoes, if you will, and being able to see something from multiple perspectives.
Yes, and that means managing, you know, or holding polarities. I mean, all the spiritual traditions talk about, you know, yin and yang and black and white, and that we have to be able to hold the polarities of some of these values. So, you know, it's just the one we were talking about. You've got on the one hand, you know, everybody wants safety, but, you know, does safety come from being protected by someone there with a gun, or does safety come from having no guns anywhere around? I mean, that's a dialogue that communities need to have, and the first place that dialogue starts, I think, is inside our own hearts, Stephen. That's where it starts. It starts in my heart, and I'm speaking from experience, because I've had to open my heart in the work that I do again and again and again. I mean, I've had to do it in my marriage, I've had to do it with my kids, and not surprisingly, I have to do it as a citizen.
How does this relate to the notion of letting go of control? So I think one of the things in your book you really talk about is the shift from control to relationship, and how important that is when we're engaging politics.
Well, I think if people think about politics, they often will say, who's going to control the House? Or who's going to control the Senate? Or who's going to control the White House? People think in terms of, you know, which party is going to control. Just like in our personal relationships, we often think, you know, who's in control here in our families or in our communities. So control is a natural desire. We naturally want control to be, you know, in the right hands, whatever we think control is. But I think control, just on a personal level, we all know that if a husband's trying to control his wife, it's not probably going to be a healthy relationship, you know, if it's all about control. And I found the same thing with U.S. Congress. The Democrats, you know, ran Congress for 40 years, and their 40-year control of Congress ended in 1994, which was right when I was starting to work with them. They lost control of the House. And what happened when they lost control of the House was that the House of Representatives had to learn how to be about relationship. And the Democrats and Republicans 20 years ago had to say, oh, my God, we're in a relationship, and it's not about control, because it was not clear who was going to control the House at that time, you know, and every year, every 2 years, it's up for grabs, you know, who's going to control the House. So I'm old enough now, and you're old enough to know that it's not only about control, it's also about relationship. And what's happened is that, you know, after years and years of it all being about control, the relationship has gone into the gutter. And that's why, you know, we need to do some relationship work. And I believe that healing political divides is among other things, not only about learning, it's about relationship.
How does that apply, the whole principle of letting go of control, in, let's say that you're in a family dynamic and you've got, you know, let's say a brother who's very, you know, really a staunch Republican and you're more of a Democrat and you kind of have a lot of tension around it. So how do you apply the principle of letting go of control to, like, deepening that dialogue and relationship and shifting it?
Well, on the family level, it's really actually exciting because, you know, it often happens at Thanksgiving or Christmas or family reunions when you get together. And one of the things I would do if there was that tension in my family, and there has been, is to say to my, you know, let's say my very conservative brother, if that's the case, you know, we've had lots of fights and lots of quarrels in the past and lots of tension, and, you know, we started to stay away from politics now at the dinner table. And I just want to say, during this visit, I really would like to listen and hear you talk about how you see the world and stop arguing with you for, you know, just a little while and just listen, because I've never really stopped and listened to you. Something like that, and then to really do it, because I think, you know, Stephen, that's the key, is are you actually willing to listen, or are you sitting there at the, you know, at the dinner table listening to your brother basically, you know, chalking up counterarguments, you know, chalking up counterarguments the whole time, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. How can we convey that so it's like to make it real? So for instance, to let people know that you really are listening. It's like, so some of it is asking more curious questions, or how do we also get beyond, as you're talking about, the sort of the high level where it's abstractions, and get down to the kind of more vulnerable and the personal when we're talking about a charged political topic?
Well, what I found is that what you said is step one, which is, you know, don't immediately when the other side, whether it's your brother or someone in your community, starts talking and you find yourself disagreeing, rather than sitting there disagreeing, mobilize that holy curiosity that Einstein talked about, not only ask questions, but start to listen for the grain of truth. What is the grain of truth? You know, for example, when a conservative says, just to switch issues from guns to immigration, when a conservative says, we have to strengthen our borders, a nation without a border is not a nation at all. So what's the grain of truth in that? You know, let's say that we're ardently believe in freedom of movement, and we ardently are supporters of, you know, reuniting Hispanic families that have been torn apart by our immigration laws, et cetera. And we hear a conservative say, a nation without borders is not a nation at all. Well, there is a grain of truth in that. And so one of the things we can do is to the person who's speaking is reflect that back and say to our brother or our colleague or our adversary in the community, wow, I really see what you're saying. We do need to control our borders. We can't have totally open borders that are totally unmonitored and totally uncontrolled. And it's true, you know, it's true. But it means even role playing that now with you, Stephen, it's like I can feel in myself. It takes a certain amount of humility on my part to let go of my position, and as you said, put yourself in the shoes of the other person. It's humbling, you know. It's humbling, and most people, we find it hard to humble ourselves in private. So it's not surprising that our politicians find it hard to humble themselves in public.
Mm. So that's part of it. It's like the letting go of the sense of you've got it all figured out. And it kind of leads into, I think, is your third key as well. You want to talk about what the third key is?
Yeah, I think for me, learning and relationship are sort of prerequisites for actually solving a problem. And that's the third key, is to enter the domain, not saying, here's my position, here's my position, who's with me and who's against me. But to enter by saying, you know, this is where I'm starting from, but I'm here to solve this problem. You know, going back to the schools, I'm starting from the position that I don't want any guns anywhere near our schools. That's the position I'm starting with. But I realize that a lot of you have different points of view, and I'm really here to solve the problem and make this school safer for our kids. So to me, it's an attitude about why you're engaged in politics. Why are you getting politically active? Why are you politically active? Is it because you're trying to ram your position down the throats of other people? Or is it because you see a problem in our society and you're willing to learn and humbly be in relationship and try to solve that problem? And I think that's that attitude of problem solving that's the third key. And, you know, some people don't even like the word problem. They'd rather call it, you know, meeting a challenge. Or in my book, Leading Through Conflict, I talk about it as, you know, discovering the opportunity or the innovation. So if people don't like the idea of problem solving, you can also think of it as opportunity finding. You know, what's the opportunity in some of these debates about immigration or about guns or about foreign policy or about the minimum wage or education? What's the opportunity in the conflict to actually innovate and make things better? And I often use the analogy, Stephen, of the iPhone, because the iPhone, which many of us, you know, hold in our hands every day or its equivalent, those were innovations created by competing teams trying to make the best possible cell phone. And those competing teams, you know, at least in the case of the iPhone, were all working for Apple. And that competition led to a better phone. And so I see the political arena in its ideal way, that problem solving is about competing ideas. How do we make that school safer? How do we handle this challenge of immigration? How do we actually defeat ISIS? You know, how do we deal with climate change and protect our economy? You know, all those questions are problems to be solved and require a certain attitude, you know?
Mm-hmm. So I think that it's clear, like, that shift internally for just us. So we shift from position taking to problem solving, and then we're entering in differently. Let's say that other people engaged in the exploration are still in the position taking. Do you have, like, any sort of magic words or ways to sort of invite people into that problem solving mode when they're sort of stuck in the position taking mode?
Well, it's for me. That's why I always start with learning and relationship. I don't start with, hey, you know, let's sit down and solve this problem.
Gotcha.
Because
uh-huh.
They, if you start there, you hit all that resistance. So the first thing is, you know, to create a climate of learning. And to me, as a facilitator and in the work that I've done on various issues, whether it was climate change with Al Gore and his adversaries or around the defense budget or others, the key thing is that when someone is in the room, they look around the room and they say, oh, my God, I'm in a room with people with very different opinions than me. I'm not here with my little crowd anymore. You know, I'm not here with my little liberal crowd or my conservative crowd. And they feel they're out of their comfort zone. And so that automatically, just looking around the room, if you've done a good job of getting the right people in the room and you have what I call the whole system in the room, suddenly people go, oh, I better open my eyes here because I'm in new territory. And that's the first step. Because if you look in a room and, you know, there's 25 liberals and four conservatives, well, you know, the liberals, can, you know, they're kind of going to run the show. You know, there's 25 of them. There's only four people with a different point of view. Whereas if it's 12 and 12, which has been the case in, you know, or I'd rather say not 12 and 12, but if the whole spectrum is there, as there have been in many of the work, much of the work I've done, I find that people get into a learning mode almost automatically just when they enter the room. And you still have to set some ground rules, which is something worth talking about, because the ground rules are critical. When we took the Congress away, you know, some of them said to me, you know, look, Mark, foundations have put in millions of dollars. We're taking this train to Hershey, Pennsylvania for a congressional retreat. How do you know we're going to behave differently when we get to this retreat than we behave on Capitol Hill? And I said, well, you're only going to behave differently if you've got a different set of ground rules, you know, before we go away, before we spend this money, before the eyes of the nation are on us and you're wondering what happened. Let's set some new ground rules. And they did. And those ground rules are now at the heart of my work.
Yeah, it'd be great to hear just a high-level summary of some of those ground rules.
Well, the first one is respect. That's what they picked. They said, you know, we need to show basic respect for each other. The second was listening. You know, let's really listen to each other and not just listen to prepare our counterattack, but really listen. And the third one, which was very important, was fairness. Because, you know, I pointed out that some of the reasons people don't listen is if somebody's going on and taking most of the time and trying to dominate, well, they're going to get interrupted. They're going to get heckled. They're going to get criticized. So let's be fair and make sure everyone has equal time. So respect, listening, fairness, then openness to new ideas. Openness was key. And in the case of Congress, what was pivotal was commitment, meaning you're not in and out of the room doing 20 different things. If you're in a tough conversation or tough negotiation, you stay in the room and you don't walk in and out or leave or get on your cell phone. You're committed to being present. So that was the fundamental set of ground rules that they came up with, and they were absolutely key. And it made for an extraordinary conversation. The problem was, as many people who are listening probably figured out already, is that those were the ground rules for the retreat. And once they got on the train and went back to Washington, the Democratic and party leaders made sure they returned to business as usual. And the ground rules were thrown out the window, and they went back to the kind of warfare that we see today.
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of speaks to the importance of culture. So there's one political culture in D.C., and you can't change that except by changing like the whole fundamental thing. So how do we then create these microcultures that are modeling something different locally?
Well, the exciting thing is that in the last 20 years, and that's one of the things that I tell in the United States of America, I tell the story of all these great projects and organizations that have sprung up who are dealing with changing our culture. Because, you know, I wasn't the only one who had this experience of hope in the 90s that, oh, we'll bring these people together and they'll get along better and we'll get back on track. Well, obviously that's not happened. And so, you know, in the United States of America, I describe, you know, more than 40 organizations that are taking on different parts of the problem. Some are taking on the question of how do you bring people together for better conversations. Some are taking on the issue of campaign finance. Others are taking on the issue of gerrymandered districts. And others are taking on, you know, the question of the media and the very polarized media. And all of the parts of the system have to be transformed. You cannot just bring people together and say, here's some good ground rules. Let's really talk from our hearts now, guys. I mean, you can do that at, you know, Esalen or Omega or, you know, at a retreat center, Asilomar. But to do that on Capitol Hill, you can't just do it for a weekend. You've got to actually change the system that's taking good people and turning them into, disrespectful, antagonistic, hostile adversaries.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, that was really clear. So let's go into the fourth key.
Well, for me, the fourth key is kind of when the rubber hits the road when it comes to politics, which is the transition from campaigning to governing. That if we're learning and if we're relating and if we're problem solving, well, then governing is possible. But what's happened in our culture is that because we're not learning, because we're not relating, because we're not problem solving, we are in a perpetual campaign. So campaigning now never stops. And if campaigning never stops, well, then governing never begins. And it used to be that, you know, more or less on the day after, you know, the election, the campaign would be over, you know, as those letters and speeches that I mentioned at the beginning, you know, illustrate. People would say, well, I lost or I won. And, well, okay, let's get together and let the governing process begin. Well, for many years, that's not what's been happening on the day after the election. What's been happening on the day after the election is that the campaign has continued. And, you know, in the last round with Obama, you know, Republicans would say, let's make sure he fails. You know, that's been part of the Republican Party's strategy. Let's make sure Obama fails. And a lot of liberals did that when George W. Bush was elected, too. Okay, he stole the election from Al Gore. Let's make sure that Bush is a failure. And to a certain degree, you know, if you disagree with someone's policies, well, of course, you don't want their policies, if you disagree with them, to take over the country. But I'm really talking here about an attitude where you recognize that the campaign is over and governing has begun. And in this sort of that has a lot of very practical implications, because if every issue you come up with, let's say the issue is campaign finance, if you approach the campaign finance thing from a campaigning perspective, all you're going to do is disagree and fight. You have to approach it after the election from a governing perspective, which is saying, okay, we disagree about campaign finance. What are we going to do? Because we all disagree. We all agree something's wrong here. We all agree something's wrong. So let's sit down together and govern and find a governance solution to this question of campaign finance. That's the attitude and the shift that I think all of our work is leading towards, is better government and better legislation. Because right now what happens, and I know it from my personal experience, Stephen, is that when the Democrats and Republicans battle about an issue on the House floor, the goal is not to get the best legislation to serve the American people. The goal is to get legislation that makes their party look good and the other party look bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's very understandable in the months leading up to an election. But if that goes on round the clock, Stephen, you know, year after year, month after month, what do we get? We get mediocre government. We get mediocre legislation. And we don't solve problems. And that's, I think, what the American people are sensing. And a lot of the Trump supporters, as well as the Clinton supporters, but particularly the Trump supporters, I think are sensing that something really is not working, and that there's a deep agreement about.
So what's the parallel for that? So that's talking a little bit more about the national level and what happens in the political, professional political cycle, but what's the parallel of that fourth key on the individual or family or community level? Like, what if we shift, we sort of have a day of reconciliation, as we've talked about, where people too consciously letting go the grudges from the last cycle and really move towards, you know, reweaving the family or back together, or
yeah,
what do you think?
That's a great question, Stephen, and I think it goes back to what we've just said about the first three keys, that, you know, it's an invitation, I think, whoever is taking leadership around this issue of making that shift from campaigning to governing would take leadership and try to shift the energy, whether it's in a family or in a community or in a city council or a school board, that the goal would be to shift and create an environment where they say, look, you know, it's been really hard recently. We've been really stuck. There's been a lot of angry debate, and we're not making progress. Can we all commit to sort of stepping back and saying we're going to learn together and really listen to each other and really try to solve this problem? And here's maybe some ideas about how to do that. And for me, when I'm coaching organizations or communities, or for that matter, Congress, I do start with ground rules, Stephen, because people often say, well, it all depends on the facilitator or the leader. Well, I often say to facilitators and leaders, you're no stronger than the ground rules that you're standing on. Let's take a school board. If you're facilitating a school board meeting and the school board meeting has no ground rules, well, then you're going to be a very weak and ineffective facilitator. Because what are you going to, you know, the equivalent would be, Stephen, you know, if an umpire was out, you know, on a football field or a baseball diamond and there was no agreed upon rules. Well, he could wear his black and white striped shirt or whatever, but, you know, no one's going to follow his lead because there's no agreed upon rules. And that's kind of where we've come to in our politics. When you look at this year's election, it's very clear that most ground rules that we thought we had, they're gone. You know, they've been trampled on. And
weren't even aware of necessarily. It was just more implicit.
That's right. That's right. We didn't even know that was a ground rule until someone broke it. We said, oh, my God, that's really – we use the word crossing the line, you know, crossing the line. And that's,
right.
Again, a sports metaphor often, which is – you know, I've often used this analogy that, you know – and that what's really important here, Stephen, is I think if people understand sports, which most Americans do, that we all know that if a game starts and the lines on the football field are not clear, if it's not clear who the refs are, if it's not clear that the refs or umpires are working for a neutral, you know, organization, that in other words, they can't be in the pocket of one team or another, when we as fans see those things not being done, we go, hey, wait a minute. We're not ready to start playing here. The lines aren't drawn. The chalk lines aren't drawn. Or where are the refs? Or, you know, whose rules are we using? You know, I mean, all these things are basic to sports. Well, I think they're even more basic to civic life. And that's why we're in such peril and why governing, to go back to your question, why governing is so hard is because governing requires adherence to some ground rules. And I think the ground rules that we adopted at the congressional retreat need to become the ground rules for governing. They can't, and ideally they'd become the ground rules for campaigning, but that's a little bit idealistic. They definitely need to be the ground rules for governing. And I think that's a critical shift and what we're working for. That's why, you know, the course we're working on here is called Healing Political Divides. It's about setting a new set of ground rules so we're healing, not wounding.
Do you think that's useful to do? Let's say that you're in a more personal setting too. Let's say that we're going back to the conservative brother and the very progressive brother who have kind of a detente between them around talking about politics. So do you think that entering into sort of a healing conversation, it's good to establish some ground rules explicitly so that you're saying, hey, can we agree to let's explore this in this kind of way, and that helps to set a framework that turns the dialogue in a healing direction.
I do, and I think, you know, I don't ever tell people to use my ground rules or Congress's ground rules. I always say it's important for a family or organization to set their own. That doesn't mean you can't take some pointers from people who've done the work before, but the ground rules that I've mentioned, you know, about respect, listening, openness, fairness, et cetera, that's a pretty good starting point. And over having done this for 20 years, Stephen, what I find is that when you let groups develop their own ground rules, whether it's a high school, a school board, city council, or members of Congress, they basically come back again and again to these core values, which are the core values of America. You know, respect, openness, listening, fairness. These are core American values that the founding fathers tried to build into the system. But where it, you know, why it's up to each of us and why it matters in our families and our workplaces, et cetera, is that, you know, you can't legislate respect. I mean, there's no way. You know, you can legislate against hate speech, but you can't legislate respect. Respect has to come from our hearts, and openness has to come from our hearts. And fairness has to be in our hearts as well. Again, we can have fair, you know, voting rights laws, et cetera, but ultimately, all these values rest in our hearts. And the good news is they're shared across left and right on the citizen level if we can return to those core values. And that's really what ground rules are about, is for a community or an organization or a family to say, these are our core values. And for me, I'll just go back to learning for a moment, because you cannot learn. What I've realized is you can't learn when you don't feel safe. Safety, basic safety, is fundamental in a marriage. It's fundamental in a family. It's fundamental in a school. You can't learn. You know, if a kid is worried that someone's going to be attacking them or bullying them or hitting them, or it's very hard to learn. You're busy looking over your shoulder and trying to protect yourself. The same is true in a marriage. The same is true in politics. So I think ground rules are really about safety. So everybody knows these are the ground rules. And, I mean, the other analogy is sports, Stephen, that, you know, it's like if you're playing – if you think you're playing touch football and someone suddenly comes and tackles you at the knees, you feel betrayed. You know, you feel betrayed, like, wait a minute, you know, I thought this was touch football. Well, that's why the ground rules are so fundamental at every level of life.
Well, there's so much great wisdom in what you're sharing. So I want to focus now on the upcoming program that you're offering, because I really feel like this is such important medicine for healing what ails us right now. I mean, if the disease is the bitter partisanship and the end result of the disease is a really broken country and broken families, it's really important that we address this and really do the inner work and take the steps to really make the shifts that you're talking about. So So first of all, the program that Mark is going to be teaching for us that we're really excited about is called Healing Our Political Divides, Reuniting and Strengthening Our Families, Communities, and Country. So it builds upon what we've been hearing today, some of these core principles and shifts, but it really turns it into a practical training in how to do it in a really lasting way, not just in our own personal lives, but as part of our political engagement with others as well. So you can find the course at healingdivides.com. Again, that's healingdivides.com. And it's a 7-week program, and it really is for people who recognize the challenge here, and perhaps you have some elements of that in your own life, in your own family and community, but you're also just recognizing that it's a really difficult and undermining situation to have this level of bitter partisanship in our culture. So before you take the program, you're in one place, and by the end you're really going to be much more hopeful, more affirmed about how to get there, more empowered about how you can actually make a difference and to help to break some of these partisan log jams in how we engage politically. So it's really for people who care about our country, and it's great for civic leaders of different kinds, as well as people who have any sort of an impulse towards peacemaking or bridge building, or anyone just really concerned about the vitriol of the other party. So it's an exciting program. Mark, you want to share a little bit more in your own words what people are going to come away with the 7 weeks with you?
Absolutely. Well, we're going to start in a surprising way in week one. I think it'll surprise a lot of people because we're really going to start with our bodies and our hearts and our minds. Because what I found in this work is that politics is both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing because we feel connected to something larger than ourselves, but it's a curse because we often feel like we've lost our own inner power. We feel powerless. And so for me, I don't want people starting this course from that place of powerlessness. So we're going to look straight in the eye at that powerlessness and ask ourselves, how can we experience a sense of inner power when there's these forces going on around us that make us feel powerless and afraid? So how do we make that shift from an inner feeling of powerlessness to a sense of empowerment? How do we go from a fear to a place of love and connection? How do we reclaim that inner sense of wholeness and connection? And we're going to have a guest who really has done that kind of embodiment work for a long time, and we're really going to spend that hour sort of grounding ourselves, and then I feel we can move on to week two, where when we have that sense of power, inner power, we can start to say, all right, can we hold the paradoxes of left and right? Can we hold that? And I feel the body is very important because the analogy I use, Stephen, is. When people talk about change, being liberalism and stability or conservatism, our bodies are about change and stability. Our bodies change over our lifetimes. We want them to change, but we also want, stable, temperature, 98.6. We want some stable heartbeats. We want stability. So our bodies are holding paradox all the time. Can we do that? And, I think healthy citizenship and healthy humanity is about holding paradox and holding competing positions. And I think that means getting out of our partisan prisons and getting out of our little bias bubbles, whether it's a liberal bias bubble or a conservative bias bubble, and doing what you talk about so well, Stephen, which is, political cross-training. So that's week two. And I think that prepares us to go to this challenge of, okay, what does it mean to go from position-taking to problem-solving? And we're going to really dive into the practical skills and tools of both in ourselves and with groups. How do we take a group that's basically, fighting and competing and opposing? How do we take that group to an attitude of problem solving so that they frame issues so that the group is leaning towards solutions rather than leaning towards division? And when we've completed those first 3 weeks, I think then we're really ready to look at, the art of negotiation. And we're going to have as a guest Dr. William Ury, who wrote Getting to Yes, and with Bill, we'll look at, after 30 years since Getting to Yes was published, what have we learned about negotiation? And it's a tool that if we're proceeding from a place of learning and relationship and problem solving, we could actually make some progress. And that's the week when we really get our kind of negotiation training. And that prepares us then for weeks 5 and 6, which I'm really excited about, because that's when we're going to take all that we've learned and apply it to the current issues of our time. And in week five, I'll pick a couple of issues. Right now I'm thinking of probably something having to do with guns, something having to do with immigration, maybe foreign policy, campaign finance. And we'll really look at those. And I'm going to be, my guest then on for that week is going to be a Republican, a man named Bill Shireman, a wonderful Republican thoughtful leader who's done a lot of work between corporations and activists. So it's going to be a very exciting session where we look at three or four issues that you know we're presenting. In week six, it's going to be open to the participants in the course, and by that time we'll know, well, what are the issues that are, you know, concerning the people who take the course. And that entire session is going to be focused on talking about the issues that the participants want to apply these issues to. And we're going to look at, you know, what is our own stake in the issue, and how do we mobilize our own energy and power as citizens to make a difference on that issue from this place of healing political divides, rather than, you know, going out there and just, you know, trying to hit the other side over the head or being hit over the head. And finally, Stephen, that brings us to the closing week, which is going to be my talking about literally a couple dozen organizations that are ways that people can get involved, the actual things that are going on in people's communities that they probably haven't heard of, because, you know, all they've heard about recently is probably, you know, Donald Trump's hair and Hillary Clinton's emails. And week seven is going to be saying, hey, there's a lot more going on. And we're going to talk about, you know, if you're a mother or if you're a woman or if you're in education or you're a college student or you're at a university or you're a millennial or, you know, you're a business person or you're concerned about Congress or you're part of a faith community. We're going to look at all those different, you know, areas and say, well, what's actually going on? And my goal that session, Stephen, is that people will leave saying, wow, I've just heard about two or three things that I actually want to get involved in and that I think can make a difference.
Well, we're really excited about this program. I feel like, you know, I was on the road for my own book, and people would ask me, are you going to be teaching a whole course on this? And I said, well, the truth is that I think that there's somebody who's going to be much better at teaching how to actually heal these divides, and so we're going to have him teach instead, and that's Mark Gerzen. And I really feel like you've got the skill and the savvy and the background, and I feel like this is exactly the medicine we need in order to heal these divides in a really practical way, really heartfelt way. I think you integrate the psychological dimensions, the spiritual dimensions, and the really practical dimensions in a very unique way. So I'm a big fan of what you're doing and your work, and I'm happy to direct the people turned on by my book into working with you as the practical next step in terms of being a bridge builder and a healer of these divides.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's sincere. I'm not just making that up. So I want to share a little bit more about different aspects of the course. So first of all, if you haven't done a course with us before, we do the live time with Mark, which includes time you can directly do Q&A with him, which is really rich. And there's also time at the end of every program to break out into small group practice sessions or discussion groups as you wish. And so it helps you to deepen the inquiry and the knowledge and application. There'll also be different things that you can do at home to increase your inquiry and action learning. It's not homework per se, but it gives you a chance to deepen what you're learning each week. You have an online learning community on Facebook that allows you to make more connections. I think this is going to be particularly important because the work of evolving our political culture is something that is intrinsically about all of us. It's not something we can do alone, even if a few of us might write books or some of us might have more messages out in the world. It really comes down to a lot of us taking responsibility for shifting this culture. So it's great to build the connections between people so that you can really have allies across the country and really across the world for how do we do this in a great way. You also get recordings of every class session as well as PDF transcripts. The PDF transcripts are very useful because then you can be a little lighter touch with your note-taking, because you're going to have the transcripts in a few days that allow you to really go back and sink into the wisdom. It also helps you reconnect with it even a year from now, 2 years from now. We are going to continue to have more political cycles. It's hard to even imagine what the future holds if we don't turn this around. So So it's really important to have this, the recordings and transcripts for the future, so you can refer back to it and really make this a lifelong practice. I've often said to people that it's time for us to turn our politics into a spiritual practice, and how we engage is very evolutionary for ourselves, and it's about leaving a legacy for our children and grandchildren that of a democracy we can be proud of. So the course starts on September 8th. It's going to run on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Pacific time. If you can't make the live time, we always encourage you to go ahead and sign up anyway, because it is you get the recordings and transcripts, you can participate in the group, so you can really get the full value even if you're not on the live calls. But again, that's at Thursdays at 5 p.m. Pacific time. We also have some great bonus sessions that will supplement the core of the teachings and practices. The first is a Transpartisan Action Guide 2016, prepared by Rebecca Nunziato and Mark. You want to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, that action guide is a way that people can have in their hand a sort of profile of these 40 or 50 organizations that they can get involved with. So if people really want to kind of look in greater depth and go, I want to look into that, they'll have an action guide in their hand by the end of the course that allows them to actually find their way to these and find out, you know, which one's right for me. You know, I'm a student on a campus, or I'm a mom in the suburbs, or I'm a business person. Well, that action guide will help you find the places for you to plug in your energy and your care, because there's obviously people like you out there that you haven't met, and this is a way to find them.
We also have a second bonus called, which is the American Citizen Summit Empowerment Package. So this is actually a $247 value by itself. It's all the downloadable MP3s and transcripts from the summit, included people like Marianne Williamson and Grover Norquist, Grandmother Mona Palaka, John Robbins, Jackie Salad. There's a lot of great folks who spoke, a lot of deep, inspiring wisdom there. So we're bundling that in. If you did already buy that package, you'll get a special download or a special link to purchase that at a discount, so it includes your purchase price. So that's a great extra bonus and a lot of inspiration for the road ahead, especially as we enter this season where things are going to get even more intense. It's good to have the positive inspiration to counterbalance. Mark and I are going to do a deeper dialogue ourselves on practical strategies to evolve our democracy. So this is in many ways the interface of our two bodies of work that we've brought forward this year, and we're very excited to take that to another level with you. And we also have an extra bonus that is really going to be exciting. We have three different dialogues with conscious change makers for uplifting our politics, and this is something I've started doing. And so this includes Joan Blades, who's one of the co-founder of Move On, and as well as Living Room Conversations. We also have Steve Behrman, who is not only a comedian, also a great political thinker, and Samuel Bonder has done some really interesting work. So we're going to bundle in three sessions there when you sign up today by midnight. So this is really exciting and gives you a taste of what's happening in the American Evolution series, and you get those extra three dialogues when you sign up by midnight Pacific time. So we've got a lot of value bundled in here. It's really an investment for yourself and your community and really our larger country. So it's just three payments of $109, or you get 10% discount for $297 when you pay in full. And you can find this all at healingdivides.com, healingdivides.com. So I encourage you to go over to the page, give it a read, look at the various testimonials, really amazing testimonials about Mark and his work. You've already heard his clarity and his wisdom on this call and his great heart and really his skill as a facilitator and teacher. So you're in good hands to do this deep work of healing the divides that are really breaking down our democracy. So, great stuff, Mark. I'd love for you to share just in this last minute or two any reflections or any invitation to folks who are considering joining you for the full program.
Well, I just want to add two thoughts, Stephen. One is that I'm really excited about the lineup of guests who will be part of the course, because I don't want people only think that this healing political divides comes out of, you know, my book or your book or any single person. And so the guests that we're having are, to me, symbols of the wisdom that's out there, Melissa Michaels, who's a body-centered educator, will talk about the body. Barbara Edwards, who's worked with, you know, Stephen Covey, will talk about holding polarities. Ron Kirchner, who's one of the most gifted coaches in the political arena, is going to talk about, you know, his work coaching people in the political world and what difference he's made as a, and Bill Urey's going to talk about negotiation, Bill Sharman, who I've already mentioned, and finally John Steiner, who's founder of the Bridge Alliance and really knows those 40 organizations as well as anybody. So one of the things I'm excited about is our guests and the different voices that we're going to have from left to right as part of the course. And then I just, the final thought I want to share, Stephen, is that I just want to underscore that for me, the value of this is not only for someone as a citizen, but it's also as just a person, that all the things we're going to be looking at, it's very possible that people will say, you know, I didn't know quite how to apply this politically this year, but boy, it made a difference in the way I talked to my son or daughter, or it made a difference in the way I listened to my husband or wife, or I took this to my workplace and these skills were really relevant. Because that's the truth of this. We're trying to take it down from that level where we all feel a little powerless and we all feel a little overwhelmed and confused, and take it down to that level where we have our own power, we have our own sense, we have our own common sense, and where we know we can make a difference.
Beautiful. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your wisdom, for your empowerment, for the really clear insights that you shared today. And thank you so much for partnering with us on the upcoming Healing the Political Divides program. I know this is going to be such an important teaching for folks. So, again, you can find it at healingdivides.com. And it's, again, called Healing Our Political Divides, Reuniting and Strengthening Our Families, Communities, and Country. So if you care about our country and you care about the quality of engagement, this is the course to learn how to shift that. So again, that's healingdivides.com, and you get the extra bonus of 3 American Evolution Series dialogues with me and Joan Blades, Steve Behrman, and Samuel Bonder when you sign up today by midnight. So do go over there, check it out, and if you get a yes internally, encourage you to go for it since you're in good hands and this is really important work. For both personal and collective change. So thank you all, and thank you, Mark, for a beautiful hour together. And may we all go forth and help evolve our democracy and heal these divides and really come to the kind of clear-eyed, open-hearted solutions that can evolve our country. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. It's an exciting opportunity. I look forward to it.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Mark, and thank you all. And see you in the upcoming program at healingdivides.com.